Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
Hello, my name is Christopher Coker. I'm director of LSE Ideas, which is the principal foreign policy think tank of the London School of Economics. I'm also emeritus professor of international relations and taught international relations at the London School of Economics for 43 years. I urge you to listen to this podcast, even though it's extremely pessimistic and you may be profoundly depressed after listening to it. Listen nonetheless.
It's 19th of June, 2023. Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast. My name is Wojciech Przybylski. Miles Maftian is here with me. And we're discussing the weekly outlook state of Central Europe. There's so much, literally so much going on that it's hard to pick. And we had to take a hard decision what to condense our conversation to. There's a second part of the podcast where we have a special guest from LSE Ideas, Professor Christopher Coker, talking about China and the West, which is important, I guess, from the point of view of Secretary Blinken's visit to China, bringing a lot of new in terms of diplomatic relations between the West and China. But focusing on Central Europe, there is a number of topics. So let's get onto it. What did we decide to talk about, Miles?
There was definitely a lot to choose from. I mean, from even looking at what the new national security strategy that Germany unveiled to President Pavel, talking about how we should be monitoring Russian nationals in the West, all of these developments were in and of themselves, they can be their own pieces and so forth. So it doesn't really make sense to go so deep into it. But I think that one of the main things was that Poland and Hungary are basically intensifying their criticism of the recent EU deal on handling asylum seekers, right? And basically what this means for Kaczynski calling for a referendum.
Yeah, but which is an understandable position given Hungarian context in which this particular card has worked, and it has worked also in Czech Republic and Slovakia. But here's the thing, in Poland, it not necessarily have worked in the past. It has had one singular effect, but currently the opinion polls even do not indicate that PIS would have a winning strategy, a winning card by pulling this trick on referendum in Poland. The opinion poll survey by Rzeczpospolita from last week has said that nearly 55%, just above 55% of respondents would say that Poland should take a migration deal. And in stark opposition to that, we're only 32%. So exactly the numbers that PIS has, which leads me to a conclusion that PIS is not really running for winning the elections. It's just about keeping the consistent pool of voters close together, as the majority now is opposing what they have to say. Of course, it helped Orban with a minority of support to consolidate power over time and win the big societal majority. But in Poland, it doesn't look like that. Also, because we have seen the campaign manager from PIS being dismissed last Friday. We have seen also a number of reports coming up from PIS saying that Kaczynski might be actually rejoining the government per se as one of the ministers, which usually sends a message that there is trouble in the party. And it looks like the party is more in the defensive. I am not close to say that PIS is going to lose these elections, but they are definitely desperate and looking for subjects that used to help them in the past elections and that are currently not necessarily working with the opinion poll, with the opinion public that we see through the recent poll. What do you think?
Well, I mean, the idea here is that it's June 19th, which means that we still have, I guess, years in terms of election time when you think that it's going to come in October. And I know that you know, we've talked even behind the scenes here, just from desk to desk about possibly Kaczynski basically coming back into power, right, and being part of the party. So there's a lot there. I think one aspect of the poll that we highlighted, and I think is really important, was that it's almost as if Polish voters are acting somewhat pragmatically, right? So they see this and they don't necessarily react in a sort of ideological way, but what they're doing is the idea there was that they would accept the measures if it was accompanied by financial aid for millions of Ukrainian refugees that they've accepted, right?
But that's
exactly, and that tells you like which line there actually works pragmatically for voters.
Absolutely, and I think this is undervalued element of the voters' choice, not just in Poland but also in Slovakia. What we have seen also in the past in Czech Republic is that the governments that were losing were not just losing because they were not performing so great in terms of democratic performance, but they were underperforming in terms of economic performance. Mm-hmm. Specifically in Slovakia, it's been about EU funds. In Poland, we almost have stopped talking about it. People are really tired of the big promises of the EU money, and now no EU money is coming because the indolence of the current government to solve a minor issue that everybody want to be solved, which is the rule of law. And in the Slovak case, the elections are coming up on the 30th of September. Also, the absorption of the EU funds, even from the previous perspective, is now endangered, and the technical caretaker government main job is really to increase the performance, which we spoke about in a conversation with Peter Balik, the caretaker government minister for investment and innovation and digitalization, and that's actually the key. And yes, there is a bit of racism there, and in which country there isn't, and there is a bit of nostalgia for a stronger hand, and then there is some opposition to that. But at the end of the day, people really want to have their governments perform in the areas they really see important. That's economic performance one, and then there are public sectors, public policies that do matter as well. And I think this is really going to matter a lot more than all of the democratic performance as such. It's an important context. Mm-hmm. We know that there is an interlink between the democratic performance, overall democratic health, and the delivery of EU funds and investment and economic prosperity. But on average, maybe this message hasn't been so much patched together, yes. So I'm thinking this is number one. Yet we are in the context, we haven't even mentioned once today Ukraine,
right?
But this is in the context of the Russian war on Ukraine, of course, and the Russian moves on Belarus. So these are quite significant, right? The nukes in Belarus.
Absolutely. So there were many other different stories that we could outline. I mean, of course, when you look to see what happened in Hungary with the U.S. essentially blocking some of the delivery of arms, I think that was interesting. Why? Because they're delaying the ratification of Sweden's NATO membership. But then you kind of see on the Polish side that it was the head of Poland's governmental foreign policy think tank, they confirmed reports that Warsaw was defying Washington in this sense when it came to the actual Nordic candidate to be head of NATO.
Yeah, and I think this is the real interesting news of the diplomacy, background diplomacy of Poland is conducting. And to understand that, you should go and check our weekly outlook from this week. Now, let's go into the special interview we've conducted with Christopher Cocker at LSE Ideas Ratio Democracy Forum in Romania, Transylvania, last week.
So, Christopher, my simple question is, what should we watch, what should we see when we're looking at China in the ongoing struggle and war in Ukraine, but also in a bigger picture on global struggle between democracy and autocracy in the world?
Well, I think the Chinese made their position very clear in November 2021 with the Democracy Summit in Washington, when for the first time the Russian and Chinese ambassadors to Washington issued a joint communique saying that the age of the liberal world order was over and they were in the process of constructing a polycentric world order based on value pluralism, that is, respect for each civilization's values, with the idea that there is no universal set of values, let alone that Western values are universal in nature, and that they would be really aiming for a new world order. That's it in a nutshell.
So there is no expectation on your side the Chinese will play any constructive role in solving the basically contributing to the peace process in Ukraine, or they might, it's just not the peace that we would like.
Well, the Chinese had an opportunity to have stood by Ukraine, since the Russian invasion is an attack on international law and the United Nations Charter. But they have chosen to push ahead with this partnership without limits. It's an interesting move because there was a partnership, a very weak partnership between China and Russia before. It was a very transactional partnership. It was based on what China wanted, not what Russia needed. It was based largely on energy transfer. 20% of the energy comes from Russia. And there was a military component to it, the Shanghai Coordination Organization, which used to be dominated by Russia, but which is now dominated by China. They are now pushing towards something that looks more like an alliance, which is an American nightmare. It is not an alliance yet, and it's certainly not a military alliance, but it's getting closer and closer. The important thing is it's a completely asymmetric relationship. The Russians have been replaced in Central Asia now by China. You may remember that when Kazakhstan refused to expel the Ukrainian ambassador to its country, the Chinese backed Kazakhstan. Most military transfers now are Chinese military transfers. Russia has been pushed out of Central Asia. The Eurasian Union is a joke now. The Shanghai Coordination Organization, that's extraordinary, a Russian creation, which is now dominated by China. And as Russia gets more and more weakened by this war in Ukraine, and as the regime becomes weakened inside by factionalism, as we can see with Prigozhin, etc., the extraordinary developments in the last 2 days in Moscow, Russia will be reduced to a client state, effectively, much to the anger of many Russian nationalists who did not want that. And you have to remember, I think, Putin's original idea was to be the balancer between the United States and China, the valuable, the interlocutor valable, the honest broker, in the way that the United States became the broker between the Soviet Union and China, with Kissinger's opening to both the pyramid with US at the top. There was going to be a pyramid with Russia at the top. That dream, of course, collapsed with the invasion of Ukraine, and it's not going to be resuscitated. That's, I think, where we are where the situation stands at the moment.
And is the Western response, including both US and the European Union and Great Britain, NATO overall, is that something you would assess is at least going so far well, or is too little too late? And
there's an understanding at the moment by the Biden administration that if you want to avoid war with China over Taiwan, you must defeat Russia over Ukraine. In January this year, Xi Jinping told his generals to prepare for the invasion of Taiwan in 2027. They couldn't do it today, but by 2027 they may be in a position, so the clock is ticking. If the Russians succeed in Ukraine, which is a possibility, it's a war for them to lose, it's not a war that Ukraine can win, then the Chinese may be emboldened. And the Japanese and South Koreans may have to start making their own calculations. So as we heard today, the war between the US and China would be infinitely more catastrophic than a war between than the war that's going on at the moment.
What and how should we be preparing?
I didn't answer your question about Western unity. Well, we saw Macron made it quite plain in his visit to China that Taiwan is not Europe's problem. The Spanish Prime Minister said exactly the same when he was in Beijing. I would say that 2/3 of NATO members have no interest in supporting the United States in a war over Taiwan. The exceptions would be Poland and the Baltic states, United Kingdom possibly because of the Anglo-American alignment, which is still there in the imagination, if nothing else. But it's going to be crunch time. There's nothing the Europeans can do to help the United States in a war. And we're beginning to get scared about what that war would look like, largely because of the semiconductor industry. The United Kingdom conducted a war plan 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago, predicated on the fact that within the first 36 hours of the invasion of Taiwan, the microchips are no longer available. Semiconductor industry is destroyed in Taiwan. It came to the conclusion that Britain would, that the internet would collapse in 3 days. That Britain would have no internet access. And this is something, of course, that Medvedev threatened yesterday, that we can stop, but the Russians can't stop the internet access. They can do a lot of harm. And it's not a fact that China would necessarily want to stop it, but it would collapse of itself.
Mm-hmm. What's the use of this catastrophic vision and pessimism in politics?
Well, politics is always based on pessimism, not optimism. But it used to be based on probabilities rather than possibilities. You may remember after 9/11, Cheney came up with there only has to be a 1% chance for terrorist attack. We can't allow that 1%. Well, that's always nonsense. We have never prepared for 1% contingencies. We prepared for 50% contingencies, mostly 70% contingencies. The Americans tried to shift that. They, even in their strategic doctrine, if you look at their national security strategy after 9/11, the preemptive war. This is a complete reinvention of international law, the right to invade a country because you want to preempt it from doing something it hasn't yet done. That was dropped in 2005 for the national security strategy. Why? Because the Europeans opposed it. They said it was against international law. The Americans dropped it. So they can be influenced by their allies. But it's not about a rift between the US and Europe. The Europeans have defined China as a systemic threat. I wouldn't be surprised if they define it as a strategic threat quite soon. NATO identifies China as, after Russia, the second most important threat. It's not terrorism or anything like that any longer. But there's nothing the Europeans can do. And we had, you may remember, one aircraft carrier that we sent into the Taiwan Straits. Was it 2 years ago or a year ago? And there's no doubt that the Chinese would sink that in half an hour, using underwater drones, hundreds of them, in the same way that you'd have used torpedoes in the old days. You know, we lost two battleships, Prince of Wales and the Repulse, in 1941 when we sent them to support Singapore against the Japanese. They were sunk in half an hour. Chinese can do the same. We have no military capacity. And although we have this AUKUS agreement with Australia and others, it's meaningless if you look at the actual force commitments. And those nuclear submarines will not be ready until the 2030s. And by that time, the Taiwan situation will have been resolved one way or the other.
Mm. But that means that all of the planning and the spending on military that Europe is now making early steps as a European Union are all a bit of nonsense, really. If that will not bring results, we should focus on something else in the common effort.
Well, deterrence can be based on planning. It's the important thing. I mean, why did the First World War happen? Very simply because the British couldn't bring themselves to have an alliance with France or to undertake giving Belgium a defense commitment or introducing conscription. And saying we can put a million soldiers in the field in 2 months. If they'd done that, there wouldn't have been a First World War. Mm-hmm. So this is the lesson that we learned from forward planning. Tell the enemy exactly, be as transparent as possible. Tell them that you are preparing this and they may back down. Mm-hmm. But of course, the bluff can always be called, and particularly when the wherewithal, the actual capabilities are not particularly impressive.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the conversation. That's, I think, as far as we can get in terms of warning in an interview.